complex structure given by this Beltrami differential. The holomorphic functions are x squared wi and ui u1, which is, say, w1 z minus w2 bar w squared. And you can check, oh, there's a factor of n here, factor of n. And you can check that, you know, if you plug these guys in, let's call this guy beta. So d bar ui plus beta ui 0, which you can check just by differentiating this guy with respect to the dw bars. And there's probably about a 50% chance I got the sign wrong in these formulas. In any case, u1 w2 minus u2 w1 is n, so that the deformed geometry is SL2C. So what we're gonna study is, we're gonna study kind of excitations of the B model near the boundary, like Witten diagrams. I'll explain what they are. And then we're gonna relate them to the large N chiral algebra. So let's go back for a minute to the large N chiral algebra. And I want to explain some general techniques for computing BRST cohomology, large N. So this has the fundamental operators there's z1, z2, which are adjoint valued out of spin a half. And their OP looks like 1 over z. So A and B are Lie algebra indices, and this means the pairing on the Lie algebra. Or to take the Killing form. You also have E and C, which are fermionic, adjoint valued, so they have Lie algebra indices. And E is a spin 1, C is of spin 0. And these have the same OPE. So far it's just a free theory, and what makes it interesting, what makes it like not a free theory, is some set of free fermions and bosons, the interesting data is the BRST current.
just like this. Not that it matters.
Yeah. I'm not going to worry too much about this raising and lowering of that. These guys are structure constants. And for simplicity, I'm going to assume that I have a basis where this is delta V. And the second term, so this is CC times B. And the second term is a factor of 2. We'll have a ZZC in it. So what the thing that will match the holographic computations will be the BRST cohomology. So let's see what this looks like. So if I think of qubit BRST of an operator, so for example, what is QBRST of CA? We look at this formula and we notice C contracts only with B. So it was going to be given only the first term will contribute. So it's half integral over Z FABC CA Z CB at Z, B, C, at Z, C, D, at 0. Well, I'm doing a contour integral over Z. So the only thing that will contribute will be anything involving a 1 over Z. We'll get a 1 over Z only by contracting this. Like I move this past there, and I'll pick up a factor of 1 over z times delta c. That is half FABD CA 0 CB 0. Okay. So think, does everybody feel like they can do this, figure out what the BRST charge applied to an operator is? Okay. Now, if you give me some big composite operator, some word in the B's, C's, and Z's, this thing might be quite complicated because it might involve a bunch of contractions. However, we can approximate the BRST operator by the one which has only single contractions, like the semi-classical one. So that's what we will actually compute. Compute the cohomology. BRST. We'll first compute Q semi-classical, which is the term involving only single contractions. Thank you. And then the formula is Q semi-classical is I can remove a CA and insert a CB CC. A factor of two. That's what we just found there. So let's think about what are the other terms. What do I do to z's? Well, I can remove a z1. And I get back a z1, because z1 contracts with z2, so if I remove a z1, I pick up a z1 again, together with a c. So, say sum z1 acb. And then the same thing for z2 with the minus sign. And is that it? Well, we can also remove a b, because b can contract with c, so in that first term, we'll remove a b and get a cb, or we can remove a b and get a z1, z2. From the second term. So plus wow. Remove a B. Plus, remove a B. Okay, so this seem right. Okay, so our goal is to compute the cohomology of this. But I haven't really been super clear about what this will act on. So compute the cohomology of this on the vector space spanned by of local operators. Which is spanned by, well, contains CA and also the derivatives of CA. BA, the derivatives of BA, and ZI. Because the primary fields are the Cs, CB and ZI. And these are their descendants given by space-time derivatives. So all local operators are obtained this way. And now we're left with what looks like kind of an extremely, at first sight, a pretty difficult problem. Because this space is huge. So I have this operator on it, so I have some matrix, and I want to compute the cohomology of a matrix on some kind of giant vector space, the cohomology of this operator on some giant vector space. And if this operator was completely random, that would be some intractable problem. And it turns out that this kind of problem of computing these infinite dimensional cohomology groups comes up quite a lot and is often very difficult. So if I took my gauge group to be, I don't know, SO5, SO6 or something like that, I wouldn't actually know how to do this. But if I take it to be GLN for n very, very large, there's a trick to doing these computations where everything simplifies vastly. This is a very mathematical trick. It's let me try to explain it.
So I have to go
delve into some homological algebra a little bit. First, to rewrite that, we notice that this is the Lie algebra cohomology of the infinite dimensional Lie algebra GLN, where like n by n matrices whose entries are series in three variables, one of which is even, and these guys are odd. And Zi corresponds to epsilon I. C corresponds to no powers of epsilon. And B corresponds to epsilon 1, epsilon 2. So I'm not sure how much people will benefit from this if they don't have such familiarity with abstract algebra.
So
the statement is, I'll just say the statement very quickly and then I'll use it to tell you the answer. So this theorem, which is like a packaging of results of Lode, Quillen, Segan, Kahn, Rothschild. Some kind of packaging of a bunch of work in abstract algebra. That when n goes to infinity, this Lie algebra cohomology is the cohomology of so it's the symmetric algebra on the cohomology of something simple. So I'll just say this very quickly. If people are interested in more details of how to use this algebraic machinery to do these computations, I can explain later.
So it's the
cohomology of the complex. I take looks like this, where the differential
is the answer, and it's much simpler because Q is now linear. It takes z to u times epsilon, so it's much, much smaller. There's only finitely many variables here, whereas over there we had infinitely many variables. So this cohomology is extremely practical to compute. And this cohomology computes exactly what it computes is the single trace operators. That's why I said it was the symmetric algebra. So by using these techniques, we can figure out a formula for all of the single trace operators. And again, I won't give you the details of going from this expression to how you derive this formula. It's not that hard. So conclusion. We have a formula I wrote this wrong. It's still a very simple expression. So conclusion, we have a formula for all single trace operators. So the formula is they are the bosonic operators trace d by dz dk di1 and here we're taking this is the symmetrized trace. Again, sorry to skip over some details. If you follow this, if you're familiar with this, this is very easy to derive. So there's the symmetrized trace of the scalars and their derivatives. Another bosonic tower of operators is I can take the derivative of trace, say epsilon k on or s trace c or del cs. So here I'm doing like an anti-symmetric contraction. And then I'm taking the symmetrized trace of a bunch more of them. Fermionic. Again, derivatives of trace of D against a symmetrized expression. And the final one is derivatives of trace of del C against a symmetrized expression.
Okay. So here, C can be either C1 or C2. Can you mix them?
Yeah. Yeah, you can mix them, yeah. That's important. So here,
Like these indices indicate whether it's one or two.
Oh.
These, see, I didn't.
Oh,
those are the, like, which. Which of the two fields they are, they're not the Lie algebra indices. So because it's symmetrized, we're taking the trace. So at the end, we got rid of all the algebra dependence. And this guy, expression here, is in the spin m over 2 representation of SE2OR. Okay, so I didn't think I was super clear with all of this, but any questions? So, in each case, for instance, you can see if you just look at the primary, and you drop this term, this is in the spin m over 2 representation of SU2. So it's dropping the derivatives. Spin m over 2 for the OR symmetry. And also, m over 2 for a space-time symmetry. So this one, the spins are like m over 2, m over 2 plus 2, m over 2, m over 2 plus 1. That's when the b goes to disk of spin 1. And this one is in m over 2, m over 2 plus 1 as well. Okay, so any questions about this? Maybe I should explain more details how to get these answers, but I feel like I lost my nerve halfway through the computation.
And do we get quantum corrections?
No. No. It's a bit tricky to verify, but you might worry about like having more than one contraction or ordering ambiguities giving you quantum corrections. But if you stare at these representations and use the fact that the BRST operator must commute with all of the symmetries, so it must take representations like this to a representation like this, because the spins are different. Or we must take a primary to a primary of the same weight and commute with the SU2OR. SU2OR action also take a boson to a fermion. There's no maps between the representations of that nature. So it's not possible to have any quantum corrections. You can ask what happens on the holographic side.
So the usual story, so this manifold is ADS 3 times S3. With the usual story, is that you would consider solutions to Einstein's equation which near the boundary, they become localized at a point in the boundary. So here's a picture. This is the ADS 3 over here. This is the boundary. You want to consider a solution, again, if it has more perturbation of the background, given by some metric, which solves Einstein's equation to leading order, and near the boundary, it's localized to this point. But as you go away from the boundary, it can expand off. Perturbation. So the collection of such, right, your perturbations of the space-time should be the space of local operators. So this is the usual ADS-CFT dictionary. So an alternative way, which I think is a bit cleaner for our setting, is to see the following. So there exists a unique solution to the Einstein equation. On ADS 3 with a specific growth near the boundary. So like there's a way of specifying the growth conditions of the metric such that once you fix the growth conditions of the metric, the Einstein equation is uniquely solved. So if you take a small perturbation of this guy, which satisfies these growth conditions except at a point, so you'll get the same answer. All perturbations of the original metric satisfy these growth conditions. Then this space is also isomorphic to the large and local operators, like this space here, sorry. So in other words, the thing that is going to give me an operator of this CFT, I can think of these growth conditions. For example, if we're in a hyperbolic space in two dimensions, the metric has a quadratic pole on the boundary. You can think of that as that growth condition is like a boundary condition. And we're modifying the boundary condition at a point to give me an operator. Okay, any questions about this? I hope I didn't. Physical ADS CFT is not really my forte, so I hope I didn't mess something up. But seem clear? And I think lots of physicists would be kind of unhappy if you talk about, like, this is a boundary condition, because it really is, you know, in terms of the metric on ADS3, the boundary is infinitely far. But even so, this is one way to think about it. So what we would like to do the same thing for Godire-Spencer theory. We'd like to take Godire-Spencer theory and impose some growth rates of the fields at the boundary. And by studying the modifications of that boundary condition, we should find the space of local operators we've enumerated here. So SL2C is a collection of T2W1 holds n. So I have four complex numbers satisfying this equation. So we can compactify this guy into a compactification which lives inside CP4. And all we do is that we lift these coordinates, these four coordinates, into homogeneous coordinates and introduce another one on the other side. So CP4 is, of course, the quotient of C5 minus the origin by C star. And we're going to use coordinates U, capital UI, WI, and Z. And to write down a submanifold of CP4, I need to give an equation which is homogeneous in these variables. So we just take the equation we had before, and we force it to be homogeneous. So capital U1 W2 minus W2 U1 is going to be n times capital Z squared. So this defines what's called a quadric.
So the original SL2 is the locus where z is not zero. Now the holomorphic boundary, SL2C, is then the locus where z is zero, and that's inside a projective space CP3. Now, maybe, I don't know if everybody knows this, but you know, this is the set of, we're taking a four-dimensional vector space and looking at the collection of four-dimensional complex vector space with an inner product. This is the collection of light-like rays in four-dimensional complex space. People may or may not know that the collection of light-like rays is a few copies of the two-sphere. So this is CP1 times CP1. I mean, some standard fact of algebraic geometry that a quadric in CP3 is always given by CP1 times CP1. So the boundary of SL2C looks like this. So we want to talk about boundary conditions, but let's just talk a little bit about the geometry of this space and how it relates to ADS3 times S3. So SL2 is like Euclidean ADS3, we'll call this H3, times S3. Boundary SL2 is CP1 times CP1. So what's happening? Where's the boundary of H3 times S3 will normally be taken to be S2 times S3. So what's happening is one of these CP1s is this two-sphere, and this guy is the hop vibration over this one. The S2 at the boundary of H3 is one of the CP1s. And the S3 is the hop vibration. So, and when we study like Witten diagrams and usual holography, we would be thinking about take a point on the boundary of H3, and I'd modify the boundary condition there. That modification might be spread out all over this S3. So to mimic that, in our story, we should modify the boundary condition at a point here and is wrapped around this guy. Because here, we, you know, it doesn't make sense to look at modifications which are entirely local in those five directions. Maybe I can try and briefly sketch a flavor of how this works, and not giving all details. And we can then check that it matches the CFT picture later. So the fundamental field is a Beltrami differential. It's kind of thing, it's a sum of DZIs and DZ bars, d by DZI and DZ bars. So in the boundary condition, we choose coordinates n, w, z near the boundary, boundary is n equals 0. The holomorphic volume form is dn, dw, dz over n cubed. If you calculate it, it turns out to have a cubic pole. So the boundary condition we'll take is that the dw, dz components of beta are divisible by n squared. And that del n component n squared. So we just have some boundary condition on the orders of zeros. The boundary. So you can study boundary modifications by changing this at a point on the z-plane to saying, so you could look at a field, which is like a delta function at a point of the z-plane, plus stuff satisfying these constraints. So for it to be a new thing, the coefficient of the delta function has to have a power of n lower than these guys, either negative or a very low order zero. Modifications. By setting beta equals say n to the minus k some delta function because this is that's I'm like really changing the boundary condition just at that point and. Well, whatever this is, it should satisfy the equations of motion. Del of it should be zero and d bar of it should be zero. So if you calculate the possible ways of doing this satisfying the equations of motion and you enumerate them, you find the same thing as we did earlier for the large Karen algebra. So maybe I can talk a bit about that next time and we can really go through these calculations because they're quite easy. Puzzle down your area.
Yeah, could you explain how you determine K? So,
well, there's going to be a whole tower of boundary modifications. And the power of K will be related to the SU2OR spin.
Okay.
The reason is that this function, there's this W direction, which is a CP1, and SU2OR rotates that. And this function n has a pole at w is infinity. So 1 over n has like a 0. So if I allow a large power of 1 over n, I'm allowed to accompany that by polynomials in w of a large order, which will be rotated by SU2R. So that this exponent will tell you the SU2R spin. And then the SO2 action will be read off just by what fields are present, the spin of the fields that are present. It's easier. I feel this.
You're pretty satisfied with this course. I don't know.